Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did women influence the outcome of the American Civil War? We're familiar with the stories of those who took over on the home front for husbands, fathers, brothers, and sons gone to battle. Other women, though, engaged in the conflict between North and South far more directly, as informants, smugglers, and even combatants. In doing so, my guest will tell us women benefited from the misconception that members of the so-called weaker sex were incapable of doing much more than waiting passively for their men to return. Karen Abbott is a regular contributor to Smithsonian Magazine and author of the new book, Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Four Women Undercover in the Civil War. Karen, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me, Chris.
So tell us what happened. You moved from Philadelphia to Atlanta in 2001, and you realized the extent to which people engage with Civil War history was very different depending on where one lives in the country.
Oh, exactly. It was quite a culture shock. You know, that sort of discussion about the Civil War does not creep into conversation in the North as it does in the South. And I got used to seeing the occasional Confederate flag on a lawn and, you know, the jokes about the War of Northern Aggression. And one day I was stuck in traffic on 400, which for quite a long time, it's a pretty crowded thoroughfare there, and looked at a pickup truck with a bumper sticker that said, "Don't blame me, I voted for Jeff Davis." So that got me thinking about the Civil War in more depth and what were the women doing. And I sort of wanted to peer deeper beyond the women who maybe sewed uniforms or raised money for the supplies for the Confederate soldiers or Union soldiers, and women who really put their lives on the line for North and South.
Yeah, this is such a fascinating set of portraits because I think we do all imagine that women had to be very strong as the people they cared about were off fighting the war. But we imagine them sort of fleeing and trying to just survive as opposed to taking an active role in the war.
Exactly. And some women just right away became more proactive. One of my favorite stories was how women influenced men to enlist. They sort of shamed men, any man who was shirking his duty to fight. There was a story of one Southern belle who sent her slave over to her fiancé, who was too cowardly to enlist, and she had a package, and the package contained a dress and a crinoline and a note, and the note said, "Wear these or volunteer." So he volunteered, and of course other women decided to become spies and soldiers and actually disguise themselves as men to enlist on both sides, North and South.
So how did you begin to collect the stories of women for this book? You profile four in particular.
Well, I was looking for women who fit the criteria of being liar, temptress, soldier, spy. That doesn't apply to one of them, but to all of them. And by the way, my apologies to John Le Carré for tweaking his title. The women I picked were those things sometimes all at once. And I wanted women whose stories interacted in some way, who were bumping into the same people, who had a cause and effect, even if they weren't physically interacting at all times. Their behavior affected each other's circumstances. And I thought that was an interesting way to tell the story of the war in a way that it hadn't been told before.
So at the very start of the book, we meet Belle Boyd, who is no relation to me, I will hasten to point out, whose first act of transgression came when a Union soldier threatened her family and she was just a teenager.
Yeah, she was a very interesting character. She's 17 years old, and it's July 4th, 1861, so very early in the war. And the Union forces are marching down in the Shenandoah Valley where she lives and planning on a victory parade on the 4th of July. And as you said, one of them threatens to raise a Union flag over her home. And Belle, who I might say has a very hot temper, would not stand for this and shoots the Union soldier and claims self-defense and gets away with it. And uses her many connections in the Confederate Army to become a courier and spy, and quickly begins seducing generals on both sides and making quite a name for herself, which was, of course, a sort of something that you don't think a spy wants to do. You would want to lay low, but Belle was the opposite of that.
I was surprised, though, here she is defending certainly the Confederacy, but also the institution of slavery. Her family owns people kept in slavery, and yet she had really surprising relationships with the people that her family kept enslaved.
Yeah, her servant, who was Eliza, was quite older than Belle and raised her. And I think this was, you know, probably a pretty common arrangement at the time. And Belle even defied the law and taught Eliza to read and write, which was illegal at the time, and even used her in espionage missions. And it was quite a smart thing to do, since nobody thought that a slave would be capable of such crafty or devious behavior. So that was something Belle took advantage of.
What kind of education had Belle had, and then how did her convictions form so strongly at such a relatively young age?
Well, Belle was well educated. Her family had a prominent business in the town. She came from a well-heeled family. They sent her to D.C., and she was actually in school and had her society debut when Rose Greenhow, another Confederate spy in the book, is sort of the ruler of Washington society. So there is an early connection there. But Belle, I don't think she was so political as just she went along with the flavor. Her family were Confederates, so she was going to be a Confederate. And she was sort of all in. She had no filter. I like to say if, you know, Sarah Palin and Miley Cyrus had a 19th century baby, it would have been Belle Boyd. She was really overt with both her opinions and her sexuality in a way that was rare for women at the time.
Yeah, she was
especially a teenager.
She went around boasting about how hot she was, basically.
Oh, she did. One of my favorite excerpts is a letter to her cousin in the book in which she talks about her perfect form and how she ties up her hair nicely and how she has perfect feet in particular. She only wears size 2.5 shoes. And she develops an obsession with Stonewall Jackson, which takes place throughout the book, the Confederate general, and tells reporters that she wants to occupy his tent and share his dangers. So she sort of is confident about her ability to seduce men of all ranks.
So another interesting character that we meet here is Emma Edmonds, who throughout the book we come to know better as her alter ego, Frank Thompson.
Yeah, Emma has quite a tragic story. She also was a teenager when the war broke out. She was 19, and she was from Canada. And her family, her father in particular, had determined that she was going to marry a neighbor, an elderly neighbor. And Emma had seen what these arranged marriages had done to her older sisters. All of them had been married off in similar fashion. And she wanted no part of this. She wanted a life of adventure, and she wanted to do something different for herself. So one night she cuts her hair, bounds her breasts, trades in her dress for a men's suit, and goes on the road as Frank Thompson. And when she arrives in the United States, she starts hearing about the abolitionist John Brown and the drumbeat of events leading up to the Civil War, and decides she's going to enlist and fight for the Union. And it's quite interesting how she gets away with that.
And before that time, she was doing door-to-door Bible sales.
Yes. Emma was a devout Christian, which I think plays a part in her decision to join. She does not believe in slavery, but I think more so she yearned for adventure. She talks about what great drama she was going to play in the war, and she certainly does.
So she would ultimately become sort of a master of disguise, and we'll talk about more of that as we go on. But let's talk about how she passed herself off. You mentioned that she cut her hair and bound her breasts, but there were, of course, even in the Civil War, some preliminary physical exams to determine fitness, right? So how did she get by this?
Well, you know, official U.S. protocol declared that doctors had to give each potential recruit a very thorough examination, but doctors all flouted these laws because they had bodies, they needed bodies to start fighting. They had to fill quotas. They just had to get the men out there as quickly as possible. So they had very cursory exams. They would make sure that somebody had fingers to that they could pull a trigger, had enough teeth which to pull off a cartridge, that they weren't deaf, that they basically were capable of just walking and shooting. They might tap somebody on the collarbone or tap them on the back and just pass them. The doctor who examined Emma just merely shook her hand and said, "What kind of living has this hand earned?" And let her go, and she was in as Private Frank Thompson.
Hmm. And then she had to convince or at least maintain the ruse with most of the other people that she worked with.
Yeah, and it was really fascinating to me how Emma, not only Emma, but about 400 women on both the North and South disguised themselves as men to fight, and how they got away with this. It was just fascinating. And I think the biggest reason was because nobody was aware of what a woman would look like wearing pants. People were so used to seeing women's bodies pushed and pulled into exaggerated shapes with crinoline and corsets that the very idea of a woman wearing pants, let alone an entire army uniform, was so unfathomable that it didn't even occur to them.
Hmm. What sort of risk would it have been for her to be discovered by the people in charge while she was actively serving?
Well, she could be arrested and be charged with prostitution. That had happened quite frequently. She would certainly be discharged from the Army, which would have been the worst result for Emma, since she so desperately wanted to fight. But it really varied from general to general, and really on how embarrassed he was at having been caught with a woman fighting for him.
It's funny that prostitution would come up. That really has nothing to do with what they were trying to do, but that's what you throw at a woman, I guess.
Yeah, it's sort of like the de facto insult or charge you could throw at her.
All right, so let's go on and introduce Rose O'Neill Greenhow. Boy, she is not exactly easy to like, but really fascinating.
Yeah, I agree. And I tried to understand her background and what made her so, you know, difficult. And, you know, she had lost 5 children within 4 years. She lost her husband in a freak accident. She lost her financial stability, and she lost her access to the White House. This was a woman who had been very close friends and confidants with Democratic politicians for 20 years. She had even served as an advisor to President James Buchanan. So with the election of Lincoln, all of that went away, and she was really desperate to regain it. And so in spring of 1861, when a Confederate captain approaches Rose and asks her to run a Confederate spy ring in Washington, D.C., she just jumps at the chance and goes with it.
So what exactly did that involve, running a Confederate spy ring in D.C.?
Well, the first thing he did was gave her the cipher. And if anyone's familiar with the Edgar Allan Poe's story, The Gold Bug, it was similar to the cipher in that story. And she memorized her cipher and started cultivating her sources. And by cultivating, I really mean seducing. Rose had quite a way with gentlemen and counted among her paramours many Union contacts. There was a Union colonel. There was a U.S. senator from Oregon. And her most important source was Senator Henry Wilson of Massachusetts, who was an abolitionist Republican and the chairman of Lincoln's Committee on Military Affairs. So you can imagine they had some interesting pillow talk.
So what she would have parties, and I suppose in some cases, before she knew people well, she would just talk to them and assume that anything they told her, they would assume she wouldn't really understand it.
That's true, and it was one of the ways, as you had said in your introduction, that women used the misconceptions about them, the preconceived notions about their being the weaker sex, the gentler sex, and sort of turned it on their heads. It was a psychological disguise. If somebody said, accused her of being a traitor, Rose would say, "How dare you? I'm a defenseless woman," and you know, would say things that would just sort of turn the accusers on their heads. So it was one of the tricks they had in their pockets, and they used quite often.
Of course, Rose didn't have only herself to think about. She had a daughter.
Right. She had a daughter, 8-year-old little Rose. And Rose, this sort of showed to me, underscored her desperation, was so anxious to have the South win and to help the Confederacy in their cause that she actually used her daughter in her espionage missions. She would take her dispatches, her secret dispatches, and tuck them into little Rose's pantalettes and send her out into the yard. And at an appointed time, one of Rose's scouts would come by and pick up the note and maybe give a note in exchange to give back to Rose. So she really put, you know, even risked her daughter.
There's a scene later on when they are in prison, and she's like lowering little Rose down into a tank of captives.
Yeah, anything she could do to get information about the Union Army, she was going to do. And she sort of taught Rose. Little Rose was her image. It was her namesake, and it was actually the third child she had named after herself. And I think she was determined that this one was going to turn out, you know, grow up in her image. And she really put Little Rose to work with her espionage and shared her values with her.
We're speaking this hour with Karen Abbott. She is a regular contributor to Smithsonian Magazine and author of the new book, Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, 4 Women Undercover in the Civil War. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. We'll be right back.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Karen Abbott. She's a regular contributor to Smithsonian Magazine and author of the new book, Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Four Women Undercover in the Civil War. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think at kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Karen, I was fascinated by the story of Elizabeth Van Loo. She had been an abolitionist, but how public was that information before the war began?
Well, Elizabeth Van Loo was a Union spy in the Confederate capital of Richmond, and it was true that she was, before the war, outspoken in her abolitionist views. And everybody there sort of regarded her with a wary eye. She was this eccentric old spinster living, you know, with her mother in a house on the hill, and everybody just thought she was sort of strange. But after the war broke out, having an abolitionist viewpoint and being vocal and public about that was very dangerous. And Elizabeth wrote in her diary of receiving death threats and being followed by Confederate detectives and all sorts of danger that started to follow her as the war went on, especially as she decided to organize a Union spy ring in the Confederate capital.
So one of the ways that she tried to make it look as if she were loyal to the Confederacy was with the flag she flew.
Oh, yes. Before the war, Elizabeth had a very large Union flag flying over her home, and she, you know, added the stars herself and was forced to take it down. It was the one public concession she made once, you know, secession began sweeping the land. And there's actually a picture of that. The relatives still have that today. And in its place, she raised a Confederate flag just to tell people that, you know, she the war broke out and now she was on the correct side. But, of course, that was the furthest thing from the truth, and Elizabeth just used that as part of her disguise.
How did she begin to organize her espionage network?
Well, I happened to talk with a descendant of her brother, who she had had two nieces, and I talked with the great-grandson of one of her nieces, who told me some things that had never been published before about her operation, namely her how involved her brother had been. Nobody really knew this. John Van Loo had inherited the family's hardware business, and he would take invoices and purchase orders, you know, business documents, and fill them out as if they were normal business documents, but each number corresponded to certain military terminology. For example, 30 hammers might be 30 pieces of artillery. 400 hinges might be 4,700, you know, cavalry. It all corresponded in some way. So when he went across the lines and if guards examined his papers, they weren't suspect. So we talked quite a bit about that and also about Elizabeth placing a former family slave in the Confederate White House as a spy.
This is a really remarkable story, and I should say this woman is almost worthy of a book in and of herself, but tell us about her.
Well, Mary Jane Bowser, I should say, back up and say that Elizabeth's father, the family did own slaves, but as soon as her father passed, Elizabeth freed all of the family slaves and began spending her inheritance to buy slaves just for the purpose of freeing them. And Mary Jane Bowser had always been a favorite of Elizabeth's. She sent her north to be educated, which, of course, was illegal, and she brought her back to Richmond, which was also illegal. And she decided she was going to place her as a spy in the Confederate White House, and she went over to Verena Davis, who was the Confederate First Lady, and said, "Well, I have a girl here. She's not very bright. She's kind of bumbling in the kitchen, but I hear you need help, and I'm going to offer you one of my servants, Mary Jane Bowser." Of course, nobody knew that Mary Jane Bowser was not only literate but highly educated and had a photographic memory. So while she's dusting Jefferson Davis's desk and picking up the kids' toys, she's also looking at battle plans and maps and listening to conversations.
I love thinking about this and thinking about how people were essentially, it sounds like she was almost invisible for a time within the Davis household. And so no one would even think about being quiet around her.
Exactly. I like to say she was, you know, not so much above suspicion as below it. I mean, no one would expect that a slave, a lowly slave, would have this capacity and would have the wherewithal to carry out what she was doing.
And so how did she get information, Mary Jane Bowser, back to Elizabeth Van Loo?
Well, they had a pretty stringent operation. It was elaborate. There was a family seamstress, a friendly family seamstress that had long known the Van Loos, and Elizabeth made an arrangement with her that Mary Jane would place whatever information she needed to in Verena Davis's dress. She would sew it up in the hem or similarly disguise it underneath a pocket and bring it to the seamstress. And the seamstress would meet with Elizabeth, and Elizabeth would retrieve the information from Verena Davis's dress and take it from there. And John would then do his work with the hardware store papers and go on to D.C. and deliver the information to the Union Army headquarters up there.
And clothes and hair actually play a significant role in all of these stories.
Yeah, I love that. I love that it's sort of the physical disguise. The women's gender was such a physical disguise. Nobody expected that there were, dispatches being sewn up in dresses. And Rose Greenhow, in the first big battle of the war, actually calls a courier over and wraps up a secret dispatch in a piece of black silk and coils the black silk up in this girl's bun. She was a 16-year-old courier. And Rose sends her along to General Beauregard's headquarters. And she gets to the headquarters and lets her hair shake loose and lets this piece of information out and actually helps the Confederates win the first battle of the war. So definitely women, gender was this physical and psychological disguise.
And can you tell us a little bit about the kind of surveillance that Rose was doing on General McClellan?
Well, McClellan took over the Army of the Potomac in the Eastern Theater of the Union Army right after the Union's disastrous defeat at the Battle of Bull Run. And Emma Edmonds is actually under McClellan's command. So while Emma Edmonds is dressed in her male disguise marching on Capitol Hill, Rose Greenhow is doing this surveillance and documenting all the comings and goings of McClellan. And McClellan was supposed to strike pretty quickly. Everybody wanted the Union to sort of rally after Bull Run and get back at the Confederates. But McClellan was a very cautious sort and did not get along with Lincoln. He actually called Lincoln nothing more than a well-meaning baboon. So for a while there, Rose just was biding her time and waiting to see what McClellan would do.
There were people who didn't think Rose was above suspicion.
Well, that's true. One of McClellan's men, who has the famous detective Alan Pinkerton, who was hired by McClellan to do Secret Service work for the Union Army, one of his first job assignments was to conduct a stakeout on Rose O'Neill Greenhow. So one night in a torrential downpour in 1861, Pinkerton and two of his best men go over to Rose's home on Lafayette Square in D.C. She always liked to say that it was within rifle range of the White House. And they climb up on, Pinkerton climbs up on his detective shoulders and peers in Rose's window. And what does he see but Rose sitting there with a traitorous Union captain. They're poring over maps and fortifications and all sorts of official-looking documents. And then Rose and the traitorous Union captain start to passionately kiss. And Pinkerton is just furious. And Rose becomes sort of public enemy number one.
And, of course, there were social consequences for some of this as well.
Oh, absolutely. Rose was called Wild Rose. Everybody took note of her, the men who came and went to her home. But she did not care. As I said earlier, she was really desperate and anything was worth getting the Confederacy back and getting her old life back.
So what happened when she went to prison and she had to take little Rose along with her? They were almost treated like a circus exhibit or something.
Yeah, they didn't know quite what to do with her. And this was an interesting part of the research that, there was actually a quote of one of Lincoln's officials saying, "What do we do with these fashionable women spies?" It was quite a conundrum. They didn't think they could hang Rose Greenhow. They didn't want to make her a Confederate martyr. They did not want to spark the ire of Europe. Europe would already thought the United States was being barbaric. So to hang a young mother and a widow would be really beyond the pale to them. And the Union was afraid to do anything. The North did not know what to do with her. Women had been victims of war, not as perpetrators, and they just did not know what to do with this woman who was actively and brazenly perpetrating war against the Union.
So the war moves on, and Belle Boyd has run-ins, and she has successful moments. Tell us a little bit about how things started to go for her.
Well, Belle was an interesting spy because one would think, like Elizabeth Van Loo, who was a very crafty spy, you want to stay undercover. You don't want to draw attention to yourself. But Belle, of course, was the exact opposite and did anything she could to draw attention to herself. One of her tricks was she had she took a little lap dog along with her wherever she went, and she would place secret dispatches on the dog's back, and she had a false hide cut precisely to fit over this dog's back, and she would wrap the dog in the false hide and send him along his way with the messages securely fastened in there, so nobody knew her dog was also part of her treasonous behavior. And of course, she just seduced people left and right, and went after generals. One of her paramours was Union General James Shields, and a Northern journalist reported that she was closeted for 4 hours with him, and afterward, she celebrated this conquest by wrapping a rebel flag around his head.
All right, so Emma, as Frank, was not typically actively engaged in combat. She worked as a nurse.
She worked as a courier nurse and spy. She was a nurse in the beginning. It was interesting to me the sort of how she evolved. In the beginning, she said she did not want to shoot anybody. She was not bloodthirsty. She thought she had a gift for healing. So she became a nurse. But once she started witnessing the bloody battles and bringing her comrades off the field and witnessing amputations and assisting and seeing the sort of brutality of war and witnessing that, she changed. And at some point, she clearly demonstrates that she has no problem shooting rebels.
Did anyone suspect her of being other than who she said she was?
Well, there were some jokes, and this is a good question. She had small feet. Her feet were so small that she had to bring her own boots. She couldn't fit into regulation army boots. So she came to the war wearing her own boots, but she passed off her smooth face by saying she was just a young boy. You know, a lot of them were smooth-faced. She modulated her voice. But still, they called her our woman. It was sort of a joke among everybody. But they all did note her bravery under fire and commended her ability to work alongside everybody, take orders.
She did tell a couple of people who she really was.
She did. One of the most heartbreaking parts of the book and of Emma is that she fell in love unexpectedly with a fellow Union soldier, a rather dashing gentleman by the name of Jerome Robbins. And they sort of start out by talking about their love for Christ and their desire to be closer to God. And meanwhile, Emma is sitting there thinking she's really falling for this man and doesn't quite know what to do. Does she suffer in silence or does she risk everything by telling him who and what she really was?
And so what did she decide?
I would hope people would read the book and be interested in finding out. But she and Jerome have quite a history in the book and a story that evolves over time.
One of the things that comes up in this book is how difficult it was for women who lost essentially two or three generations of men in the span of 4 years.
Yeah, one of the interesting sort of effects of the war was how the rules of courtship changed, the rules of family life changed, the rules of love changed. In the antebellum years, prospective suitors would have to offer a letter of introduction and meet not only parents but neighbors and acquaintances, and it was sort of a long, drawn-out process where somebody would be accepted as a suitor or a mate or a husband. But when the war came, that all changed. Everybody had gone, and anybody who was left had no choice but to relax the rules, and women were going off to Confederate camps or Union camps and being serenaded by men and taking walks with men whose name they didn't even know, you know, let alone have a letter of introduction. So it all changed. And of course, after the war, 60,000 women about were left widows and didn't have any desire or expectation to remarry, a lot of them. And a lot of men came back amputees and were unable to work. So women were forced to become breadwinners and take charge of the household. So the whole sort of women's roles in society changed as a result of the war.
And women were actually encouraged to have an open mind about marrying someone who'd been physically disabled in the war, which I gather would have been sort of socially and economically unacceptable before.
Yes, Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy, advised women to always choose the empty sleeve, which was his word for amputees, and said that they should be treated like royalty when they came back and recognized for their sacrifice for the Confederacy. But it was a hard road for everybody involved.
So, Karen, after the First World War, women who had taken on larger roles, and certainly after the Second, there was kind of a big social change. Did the changes that happened because of the Civil War in the roles of women, did they persist into the post-war years?
Oh, definitely. For example, suffrage. Elizabeth Fan Liu, who had always been a sort of feminist in her way, became a prominent suffrage activist for women's suffrage. She always would send in her property tax every year with a note of protest that she was being taxed without representation, and she would go on to have a role in government. And I do think that women's roles did change, you know, and evolve throughout the war and afterward.
How did Elizabeth come to care for Union soldiers within her own home, and how did she get away with that?
Well, she had this big mansion in Church Hill, which was the most the wealthiest neighborhood in Richmond, and she had a secret room. Now, I don't know the origins of the secret room. I don't know if it was built for what purpose it was built for, or how long it had been in this home. But Elizabeth recognized this as an opportunity to hide Union prisoners in there until they could be sent off to Northern lines. And Elizabeth was very crafty and knew exactly which Confederate officials to bribe, and even got a clerk placed in the largest prison in Richmond who sort of facilitated these escapes. And she also stationed a lot of her former slaves around the prison who would guide these men back to her home before she sent them onto Union lines.
So you mentioned that there were secret codes that people were familiar with. What kinds of excuses did these women have at the ready in the event that they were caught with something that looked very much like contraband or like a message?
Well, there is one scene where Rose, you know, being chased by Pinkerton and his men, actually swallows her note. So there was that option that was always available to them. A lot of times they would stuff things down into their undergarments, reasoning that nobody would dare search there. And Rose even had ways of communicating that didn't involve, you know, carrying a risky cipher. One of her methods was she memorized the Morse code. So between certain hours, maybe 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., she would raise and lower her blinds to indicate dots and dashes. Or she might achieve the same effect by fluttering her fan in a precise manner when she was taking her walks. So they devised all sorts of ways to get around the cipher if they didn't feel comfortable.
I was reading about the blinds and thinking, remember there was an episode of the Flintstones where Betty and Wilma did the same thing, and I was wondering if somehow that story had been available to them, and that was where the writers were inspired.
That's a good question.
My guest is Karen Abbott. She's a regular contributor to Smithsonian Magazine and author of the new book, Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Four Women Undercover in the Civil War. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Karen Abbott. She's a regular contributor to Smithsonian Magazine and author of the new book, Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Four Women Undercover in the Civil War. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. So, Karen, these days, if a woman named Emma Edmonds wanted to serve in the U.S. Army, of course, she could do so without having to conceal her identity. And then after it was all over, she would know she was entitled to veterans benefits. How did that work for our Emma Edmonds?
Well, Emma, after the war, noticed that men were getting pensions, men who were similarly injured as she was and who had served time as she had and who had done the same activity she had. Emma actually had debilitating injuries after the war, and she began to fight for her own pension and was successful at that. And it was a difficult battle because the U.S. Army for quite a while did not acknowledge that female soldiers had fought for them. So it was a matter of first just convincing them to admit that, and then getting the requisite bills passed.
Were her injuries worse in a way because she wasn't able to submit to maybe the full medical treatment she would have needed based on the need to continue concealing her identity?
That's a really good question, and it was. I mean, there were several instances where she should have sought proper medical care, and she was terrified to. She did not want to be found out. She contracted malaria. She had a horrible mule accident. And as all this is happening, she keeps hearing stories about women being discovered. She heard about one woman who a captain threw an apple at her. And, of course, she instinctively grabs for the hem of her dress. But she's not wearing a dress. And so she outed herself that way. And there was another woman who forgot how to wear pants. And she tried to pull them on by pulling them on over her head. So she gave herself up that way. And there was, of course, another woman who was a corporal in New Jersey who gave birth while she was on picket duty. So that was really quite obvious that she was a woman. And Emma kept hearing these stories, and each time she heard one, she would worry that her time was coming, her time was ending soon.
It must have been scary even to think that you couldn't get away with saying you were sort of, you know, prepubescent for much longer.
Yeah, I mean, and there was that. I mean, her hair was probably growing out. You know, I think she was a slim woman, but there was always a chance that somebody was going to see how she had to bind her breasts. There was any number of ways she could have been discovered.
She had other disguises at the ready as well, besides simply dressing up as a boy, as a teenage boy.
Yeah, once she started going undercover, and you know, she worried again about a medical exam. When they asked her to become a spy for the Union Army, she had to undergo another exam, and luckily phrenology was the main medical tool of the time, so they just sort of massaged her head, and her head felt male enough that she passed. And she went undercover first, dressed as a slave, and I think the same sort of ideas that somebody would not expect a woman to dress up like a man. No one would expect somebody to dress up like a slave. So she was able to sort of get away with that. And there was also a Victor Victoria moment where she dresses up like an Irish peddler woman. So sort of a woman becoming a man becoming a woman.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Lynn in McKinney. Hello, Lynn.
Hi, Chris. I love your show. I'm anxious to get Miss Abbott's book. I have done a lot of work and research on my great-grandmother's first cousins, the Moon sisters, Jenny and Lottie Moon.
Oh, I read about them. They're fascinating. Yeah, they're fascinating.
They are. Jenny reminds me of some things you mentioned about Belle Boyd with being rowdy, and Jenny wanted to get kicked out of the Oxford Female Academy up near Cincinnati when the war started, and she was 16. And shot the stars out of the flag, got kicked out. She got sent down to Memphis, where she lived with my great-great-grandfather. Now, my great-grandmother and the Moon sisters, there was a big gap in ages. So they didn't know each other, but technically they were first cousins. But the older sister, Lottie, was married to a Judge Clark up in that area, and he was active in the Knights of the Golden Circle. Mm-hmm. And Lottie would carry messages to Jefferson Davis and to other people up into Canada, then down into Richmond. Yeah. And one message was about asking Davis the terms for, agreement and working with the Confederacy, that the Knights wanted to know what were your terms. Mm-hmm. And evidently the answer was sent back, and Jenny, the younger sister, brought it back up on a steamboat to her older sister. But she got caught and had to pull a gun on the Yankee soldier who was trying to get her or arrest her, and did the dip the message in the water and swallow it, and got sent to Burnside, who was commanding officer in Cincinnati. And I guess Lottie used to date Burnside back when he was in...
I think he actually left him at the altar, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Jenny knew him as Buttons because she was a little girl who would sit on his lap when he'd come to see Big Sister and Shiny Buttons. But just all kinds of stuff. Anyway, they finally got sent back. He visited with all of them, but sent Jenny and her mother back down to Memphis to my family's home there. But Lottie continued to do things and would dress up in costumes and have messages hidden in biscuits and things. But you mentioned Rose Greenhow and her Confederate crew there. Did your research ever come across anything where Rose Greenhow and the Moon Sisters, was there ever any connection? Because they're going through Richmond at the same time, doing the same things.
Yeah, well, Rose was in Washington, D.C. at first and only ends up in Richmond later. But I did research the Moon Sisters, and, you know, there were so many interesting characters that I had to leave on the cutting room floor. And I remember coming across the Moon Sisters and wishing there had been more source material on them because they were fascinating. Likewise with a union spy named Pauline Cushman, who operated later on in the war in 1863 and actually got captured and sentenced to be hanged and was rescued in a dramatic fashion at the last minute. So there were a lot of women on both sides who contributed, and I there just wasn't enough there to fit them in. But Jenny and Lottie Moon were at the top of my list, and how interesting that you're related to them.
You reproduce a lot of interesting little bits of sort of direct primary source materials, and I wonder, pardon me, if you receive those from family members or if those mostly came up. Are they now sort of situated in libraries and museums?
Oh, one of my favorite ones is from New York Public Library, which has Elizabeth's papers. And Elizabeth, for a time, had buried all of her papers. She was terrified of anybody finding them, but she resurrected them at some point, and they ended up in the New York Public Library. And there's actually her death threats. There's a couple death threats from a group called the White Caps there, and it says things like, old lady, your house is going. Please just give us some of your blood to write with. And there's a crude rendering of a skull and crossbones. And it was really chilling, and I just, you know, held this in my hand at the library and had to think about how Elizabeth felt receiving this during such a heated time in the war.
For all of these women, it must have been lonely in a way that they could only share their secrets with such a limited number of people.
I agree. Belle Boyd was sort of sharing everything with everybody. So she might have been an exception to that rule. I don't think she had a filter at all. But Elizabeth definitely, and she had no friends. She only had her brother in her Richmond Underground, but they couldn't really talk to one another about what they were doing. In fact, at some point, even her servants, she had her servants involved, and they would just back up to the fireplace where Elizabeth would hide dispatches and just sneak the dispatches out of there and not say a word. And even in their own house, she was terrified. I didn't mention this earlier, but her brother, John Van Loo, was married to a Confederate woman who lived with them in the mansion. So here Elizabeth is operating her Union spy ring right literally under the nose of a woman who would be willing to report anything she saw or heard to the Confederate authorities.
Yeah, and there was no love lost between her and Elizabeth.
No, not at all. She didn't want her children around Elizabeth. She was ready to do whatever she could to help the Confederate cause, even if that meant turning against her own family and her husband.
This book made me think about all the other conflicts that we associate almost exclusively with men, in which women must have had a more active role than we've realized.
Oh, yeah. I think that there's plenty of women's stories to be unearthed in various wars. And it was just really sort of thrilling to be able to resurrect these four ladies and piece together the sort of untold stories of them in the Civil War. And, you know, of course, in the Revolutionary War, women were active, too. But it was different because they didn't talk about it. There was no Rose Greenhow shouting from the rooftops. You know, there was no Belle Boyd talking about wanting to bed Stonewall Jackson to the reporters. So it was sort of the first time in history where women really discussed their roles and were vocal about it, and their stories were able to be told.
And in some cases, their stories were told quite widely after the war was over, and they were minor celebrities.
Oh, yeah. One of my favorite stories of modern day is my husband's friend called and said that his daughter, his sixth-grade-old daughter, just dressed up as Belle Boyd for a school project,
yeah.
Which I think Belle would probably be very pleased about that she little girls are dressing up like her at this, you know, 150 years later. She lived on. She became known as the Siren of the Shenandoah and the Secesh Cleopatra and made a name for herself well after the war.
Are they all still, are their stories preserved by members of their families? Do people who have descended from them know who they were?
I got in touch with, there was actually a documentary about Emma Edmonds, in which her relatives in Canada talk about everything they know about her, and I watched that, and it was quite fascinating to get a little bit more insight into her background in the Canadian farm and how difficult it must have been for her to do what she did and pull that off. She lived as a man for 2 years before the war even broke out. So, which also probably gives you an idea of how she was able to get away with it. She was very used to living as a man by that point. And, of course, Elizabeth Van Lew's, her brother's descendant, gave me some really invaluable information that was passed along, and even artifacts. The flag that she raised the first flag in Richmond after the war ended. When Union forces marched in, Elizabeth brought her flag up on the pole, and it was flying again just at, 4 years later, and it was the first flag raised after the war.
There was a great story, by the way, of Emma Edmonds going home briefly to see her mother and her sister, and it took a while for them to recognize her.
Yeah, I love this. Before Emma went back, she had had a mole removed. So she goes back home. Her mother had no idea she was living as a man. She just thought her daughter had run away to escape marriage and to escape the unhappy family life. So Emma shows up wearing an army uniform, ironically, and a cap. And Emma's mother invites her in and says, let's just give this young man something to eat and a place to rest. And Emma says, you don't recognize me, mother? And she says, no, my daughter had a mole, and this, it's not you, it's not you. And Emma removes her cap and says, it is me. And her mother starts weeping. And a sort of a very brief but touching reunion there.
It's such a great, you know, you can imagine that as a scene in a movie.
Yeah, yeah. Emma's story is very cinematic.
Were there legends about these women that you weren't able to track down and include in the book as tantalizing as they sounded initially?
Oh, there was a diary by Mary Jane Bowser that, you know, I would have given anything to have found. Apparently, she kept a diary of all of her activity in the Confederate White House. And you can imagine, someone actually later said in talking about her work there that it would have been, you know, more fantastic than any romance you ever read. But apparently, one of her relatives or descendants, excuse me, threw the diary away in the 1950s, never to be found again. So, unfortunately, that diary is lost to history.
What a heartbreak. The thought of, even there aren't as many accounts as historians would like, African-American accounts of life during the Civil War.
Yes, and hers was just so extraordinary. And, you know, Elizabeth did, luckily, after the war, a lot of Elizabeth's comrades in the Richmond Underground, which is what she called her organization, they came forward and talked about it and testified and sort of got retribution from the Union government as much as they could. And you were able to piece together how African-Americans at Elizabeth's organization helped her. They were the ones who 3 times a week were delivering messages and hollowed out heels of their boots and going across to Grant you know, taking things to the farm and relaying messages. Nobody suspected them, and she really heavily relied on them in her operation.
Do you think stories like these will find their way into history textbooks more often now in the future?
You know, I hope so. I think there's an interest in history that is sort of the underside of history, the things that might have seemed taboo earlier, and the roles of women. I think people are fortunately more recognizing women's roles in history and being more aware of women's contributions, and I certainly hope that these women would get their due in history books.
Karen Abbott is a regular contributor to Smithsonian Magazine and author of the new book Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, 4 Women Undercover in the Civil War. Karen, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thanks so much for having me. It was great.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect produced the show today with help on the phones from Addie Sun. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.